Okay, good afternoon, everybody. I just want to thank you for coming to my talk today. I don't have any fictional companies to set up, so it might be a little less entertaining. So ideally, one of the things that we want to do in efficiency research is come up with a group of tabs that we can collect DNA samples on. We can submit those DNA samples and get back molecular breeding values that help us achieve higher accuracies in these animals. And we're working on that in the beef industry. And one of the things we wanted to explore was a method of genomic selection. So genomic selection has the potential to be really useful for those traits that are measured late in life, such as stayability measurement, where we might not have phenotypic observation on the animal till it's something like 6 years of age, as well as for traits that are measured, that are expensive to collect. And feed efficiency is a great example of one of those traits because phenotypes are very expensive. Currently, the dairy industry uses approximately 50,000 SNPs for genomic selection current prices, and as Jerry talked about this morning, that's about $150. But in the dairy industry versus their traditional progeny testing schemes, that is a worthwhile investment for them. And it's unknown, but it's unlikely that the beef industry can sustain that type of pricing structure on very large numbers of animals. So we wanted to test how we could implement genomic selection models for feed efficiency in the beef industry with a reduced marker set. So if we're going to talk about feed efficiency, I just want to take a minute to define the phenotypes that we're using here. The first is average daily gain, which for us, well, is, as I'm sure all of you know, is the amount of weight gained per day on average during the feeding period. And for us, that was calculated from the beginning to the end of the feeding trial. We have average daily feed intake, or AFI, which is a highly accurate measure of average daily feed intake. And this was collected with the GrowSafe system or with Kalin Gate. And this information was used in double duty to also calculate RFI, or residual feed intake, which was calculated as the observed minus the expected feed intake, of course. And the expected feed intake was calculated by the regression of feed intake on average daily gain and metabolic midges. So we use 50K data and two sort of competing strategies that do two slightly different things. The first of those is a relationship-based analysis, which you might hear referred to as linkage-based. And in these types of analyses, we use the underlying genetic architecture to discover what the relationships are between these different animals. And this is the foundation of the genomic selection approach that we're going to talk about today. A second is a QTL-based approach, or a quantitative trait loci. And you might also hear this referred to as LD, or linkage disequilibrium phase. And using these methods, we attempt to locate regions of the genome which influence variation in a trait. And then we can further look at those regions to locate causal mutations using fine mapping and sequencing those regions of interest. So if we look at this hypothetical relationship-based analysis, here we have two separate pedigrees. And I'm just showing sort of half of the pedigree. So this would be like a sire or a dam lineage. For example, we have this animal up here at the top, and let's say he's a sire. And he sired these two bulls down here. So they should share a genetic relationship of about a half. If we go down to the grandson, these animals are going to share a quarter. Now, these types of analysis require that we have a pedigree structure to be able to know what these relationships between animals should be. One of the appealing things about a genetic analysis is we can determine these relationships based on the genotypes of the animals. So we should still be able to come up with these fractions of shared genomic material using the genotypes rather than the pedigree structure. The other appealing thing about this method is, say we get rid of this entire generation of animals and we don't have any data on them, we should still be able to determine the genetic relationships between these two groups of animals without having that pedigree structure. Additionally, there may be an unknown founder animal which is beyond the known pedigree, which would actually unite these two groups and increase their relationship, which would provide additional information into the analysis. We had three research objectives. The first was to explore the genomic relationships between families. And to do that, we generated a genomic relationship matrix. We also used that to correct observations for relevant fixed effects to produce high-quality phenotypes from our initial observations. And we used it to estimate the number of markers needed to accurately generate a genomic relationship matrix. Our second objective was to develop diagnostic tests for feed efficiency. And to do that, we performed genome-wide association analysis using the data that we had obtained and corrected to identify regions of the genome which are associated with variation in feed efficiency. Our third objective was to evaluate a novel use for existing feed intake data, which might not be on individual animals, but is instead on animals which are fed in pen situations like in your typical feedlot. So we evaluated predicted feed intakes as an indicator trait for feed efficiency, genomic analyses, and genetic selection. And we wanted to do that to, again, maximize the utilization of data that's already available in the industry. To accomplish these objectives, we formed a large population with a couple different subsets here. The first is 862 Angus steers with feed efficiency data, and these were commercial Angus steers which came from the Circle A Ranch in Iberia, Missouri, or MFA Incorporated. And no blood samples were collected during the first year of that trial, so you'll notice we only had 698 animals which were genotyped. These steers were AI sires, so we know what the sires were, and we obtained those pedigrees through the American Angus Association. However, these steers were out of commercial Angus dams, and their pedigrees are incomplete, so the dam relationships are unknown. It's highly likely, based on what we know about the population, that these dams are related, but we don't know which ones and to what extent. Our second subpopulation here is 1,707 Angus AI sires, and this includes many of the sires of the steers that we could obtain, as well as other sires that are unrelated by the known pedigree. Again, we performed genomic DNA extraction, and we genotyped those with the bovine SNP 50 as well. And thanks to the American Angus Association, we obtained a complete pedigree for those animals that spanned up to 62 generations. So this yielded a combined data set, including the pedigree animals, so the pedigree analyses, of 35,726 animals, and we had a combined data set of animals with phenotypes of 2,405. So if we divert a little bit to talk about breeding value estimation, we know that progeny receive half their genetic material from their sire and half of their genetic material from their dam. So that's how we come up with these parent average CTDs, or breeding values, before any performance data has been recorded on these animals. We take half the breeding value of sire and add that to half the breeding value of the dam, you get the breeding value of the progeny. Now there's actually another term on there, which you probably saw in Dr. Taylor's talk this morning, and that's this phi term, which is the Mendelian sampling term. And that term describes the sampling of the genetic material that the animal obtained. So did it get a really favorable set of genes from its parents? Or did it get a really unfavorable set, or maybe it just received an average set? So when we're talking about traditional pedigree analyses, or NRM analyses, until the performance data is recorded, you don't know what that Mendelian sampling term is, so we assume it's zero, and we get a parent average breeding value. Now, when we are talking about a genomic analysis, we endeavor to account for that Mendelian sampling term earlier in life. And if we look at this graphically, here we have just a schematic representation of a genome. This is very simplified, but the purple indicates that these are two average animals, a sire and a dam, and let's say they have a yearling weight breeding value of plus 50 pounds. And we have a set of seven full sibs out of these animals, and we're going to calculate the parent average breeding value on those animals because we don't have any performance data. So what we have is half the breeding value of the sire, 25, added half the breeding value of the dam to yield the progeny breeding value of plus 50. And we would assume that all of these progeny have the same breeding value. And as you can see here, we also assume the same relationship. So each of these animals, since they're full sibs, would have a relationship of 0.5. Now, if we have extra information, such as genomic information on these animals, we might be able to tell that yeah, we've got a few average animals here in the middle, but we also have some animals over here on the right, which received a more favorable sampling of genes. So maybe their breeding value is plus 65 pounds, and those animals are more highly related to one another than these other animals down here on the other side that maybe got a really unfavorable sampling of genes. So they're going to be less related to that first animal. We've estimated breeding values in two different ways. First was in a traditional pedigree analysis. So we used the animal relationship and formed a numerator relationship matrix based on the pedigree data. We also performed a genomic analysis, and we, again, evaluated the animal relationships, but this time we used the genotypes to determine the relationships between these animals, so the genetic similarity or dissimilarity between those two animals. We looked at the results for that for the 1,707 Angus AI sires, which we had complete and accurate pedigree data on. You can see it follows mostly a linear trend if we contrast the pairwise relationships in the pedigree matrix versus the genomic matrix. But you also see some animals that are more highly related according to their pedigree than their genotype data would reflect, and you see the opposite as well. If we look at the heritabilities, we'll notice these are below literature estimates for the heritabilities. But one thing I really want to point out on these is that we achieved similar heritabilities, or in the case of average daily gain, we were able to estimate a heritability, where in the pedigree analysis we were not able to reach convergence in that model. And this was with a 20% loss in genotypic data. Because remember, the first no blood samples were able to be collected in the first year of that feeding trial. So we were missing 164 animals there. And we were able to achieve similar heritabilities given that loss in data. If we look at the accuracies from these different analyses, again, they're fairly comparable for the numerator relationship matrix with the pedigree versus the genomic relationship matrix with the genotype. And again, we have no breeding value accuracy for average daily gain because we weren't able to reach convergence in that model. If we look at the sires, the steers, we had slightly fewer in the genomic analysis, but again, the heritabilities are fairly similar. And if we go down here to 2,000, to the total number of animals in the genomic relationship matrix, we had 2,405 animals, and we achieved accuracies of approximately 0.3 across all three of these analyses. And again, I want to point out that, you know, if I'm sitting back in the audience right now, I might be saying, well, you know, not much difference between 0.44 and 0.45 there. But what I want to emphasize here is that with this 0.44 that we've achieved here, again, that was with 20% less data than we had in the other analysis. Additionally, we were able to generate EBVs with a reasonable accuracy on a lot of AI sires which previously had no feed efficiency EBV and had no direct phenotypic records on sons. So another thing we wanted to explore was how many markers you really need to accurately estimate a genomic relationship matrix. And to evaluate that, we formed subsets of SNPs that were chosen at random throughout the genome, and we had some small-sized subsets here, some moderate-sized subsets in the middle, and also some very dense subsets. And we correlated the pairwise relationships between animals and the genomic relationship matrix from the subset of markers, from these, with those, the pairwise relationships and the genomic relationship matrix, which was formed using all of the 41,028 markers that we had available. We also had correlations between those GRMs formed with those subsets of markers and the numerator relationship matrix for those animals with complete pedigree data. And if we look at that graphically, the red line shows the correlations with subsets of the genomic relationship matrix versus the full matrix, and the blue line shows the pedigree data versus the subset genomic relationship matrix. And what you notice here is that when we get to about 10,000 SNPs, adding additional SNPs into the analysis isn't going to add any more information. You'll also notice right off the bat that after we get subsets smaller than about 1,000 markers, this process becomes very sensitive to the size of the SNP, size of the subset of SNPs. So really what we were interested in was this area between 10,000 and 1,000 SNPs. If we have 2,500, we achieve a correlation of about 0.91, it's very possible that we'll have panels of 1,536 SNPs implemented in the beef industry. So we calculated the correlation there as well, and it's about 0.86. And that is roughly equivalent to the maximum correlation we get between the full genomic relationship matrix and the pedigree matrix. So if I had a population of commercial animals and I had absolutely no pedigree data on them, and I was able to calculate a genomic relationship matrix, we should be able to get a matrix which contains roughly an equivalent amount of information. Our second objective was to discover feed efficiency QTO. So we performed an association analysis for those three feed efficiency traits I mentioned previously, AFI, RFI, and average daily gain. And an association analysis basically asked the question, okay, I have this SNP marker, and is it associated with variations within the phenotype that I'm analyzing? And to perform this analysis, we used a 698 deer record. So an association analysis consisted of three different steps. The first was 41,028 single marker associations. And I know in my title I said 50K SNPs, but we've only had 41,028 SNPs that passed our data filtering and quality control. So that's why I'm talking about 41,028 rather than 50,000. So we used all of those and asked the question, is this one single marker associated with our trait of interest? The second step was a chromosome by chromosome analysis, where we took every SNP that had an association where the association was greater than our significance threshold, and we retained those and performed a chromosome-by-chromosome analysis to avoid redundant SNPs, and I'll show you why that is here in a second. Our third step was building a final model, which included all of the SNPs identified in the chromosome-by-chromosome analysis, and we wanted to do that to obtain a more accurate estimate of the allele effect. So if we look at this plot here, each of these blue dots represents the strength of the association between a SNP and our trait of interest. In this case, it's average daily feed intake, and I just chose chromosome 4 at random because all the data is too much to show in any detail. So this blue dot right up here would be the SNP with the highest association on chromosome 4 with average daily feed intake. And you'll notice most of the SNPs fall down along around 0. So these peaks are the important parts that we're interested here. And the red line is our significance threshold. So this panel up here just shows exactly what I showed you on the previous slide. But what you'll notice when we get down here is all those SNPs that are right down along 0 there have been removed from the analysis. So we chose everything, all of the SNPs with an association greater than our significance threshold, to go into our chromosome by chromosome analysis. And that's what I'm showing you here. So we scan along the chromosomes, and we find the SNP with the highest significance, the highest association, which was that one that I pointed out earlier, and we fit it into the model. So that's that blue triangle there. And what I want to point out is all these SNPs around it, all those blue dots have fallen below the significance threshold. And that's because they're explaining variation. They're explaining the same variation as the SNP that we fit into the final model. So this is what I was talking about when I mentioned avoiding redundant SNPs. Now again, that's the bottom panel on the previous slide moved up to the top, and here we fit another SNP, so the one with the next highest association. And you can see again, once we fit that SNP, more SNPs drop below that red line. And again, the third, exactly the same effect. So here I've worked up a kind of a crude animation of this process for chromosome 4, and we end up fitting 11 SNPs on chromosome 4, and what you'll notice is that as each SNP gets fit into the model, all of these blue dots eventually fall below that red line, and that's when we're done with that chromosome and we can move on to the next. So I'll show you that there. Okay, so now we fit 11 SNPs into the final model. We've got 11 blue triangles here. And you can see that none of the SNP associations are significant any longer. So that tells us we're done with this chromosome and we can move on to the next. Now, after we do that for the entire genome, we end up with this model here, these black open triangles at the bottom show the SNPs that we fit into the final model. And you'll see that they correspond with the largest peaks on this graph, and that's what we want. We want to get the most informative SNPs that we possibly can. So we ended up with panels that range from 55 to 72 SNP markers, and they explained anywhere from 54 to 63% of the genetic variation within these three traits. So our third objective was to evaluate model-predicted feed intake. And that's, the reason for that is there's very, very little data on cattle fed individually compared to the abundance of data that we have on cattle which are fed in 10-speed feedlots. And it is possible that these predicted dry matter predicted dry matter phenotypes could be used as a surrogate for average daily feed intake to boost databases until we can obtain more actual records. And they would be used as an indicator trait, like percent intramuscular fat operates for marbling score. So there's two different programs that you can use to predict these feed efficiency phenotypes, and Dr. Gunn mentioned one of those Tuesday morning, and that's the Decision Evaluator for the Cattle Industry, or DESI. The one which we used in our analysis was CVDS, the Cornell Value Discovery System. And this program operates where we provide the program the energy content of the feed, as well as the performance of the animal, such as the amount of weight the animal gains during the feeding trial, and the body composition of the animal. So in our case, we use carcass traits, hot carcass weight, ribeye area, marbling score, fat thickness, those sorts of things. And the program uses that to predict the amount of dry matter required to achieve that given level of performance. And as you'll recall earlier, we're talking about individual feed intakes on these animals. So what we did was we took each individual feed intake on an animal fed within the same pen, and we pooled those to form the pen intake, and then we used CVDS to reallocate those intakes to the individual animals so we could compare how well the program performed. Here you can see the predicted feed intake on the x-axis and the observed feed intake on the y-axis, and you can see a mostly linear relationship here, and the phenotypic correlation was about 0.7, and that's very much in line with what Williams and others published in 2006. If we look at the genome-wide association results, here we've got AFI shown with the red dot and the predicted phenotype shown with the blue dot. And these areas where I've drawn bars is where these traits line up fairly well. One thing you will notice is that average daily gain tends to be a bit, the predicted feed intake tends to be a little bit noisier. So you see a lot more dots over in here, and that's most likely due to its high concordance with average daily gain, and I'll show you that here in a moment. So one thing we wanted to ask is, okay, we have 27 SNPs that fit into a final model for a predicted dry matter required phenotype, but do those SNPs describe variation in the same regions as our other three traits, AFI, RFI, and average daily gain? So to answer that question, we took those 27 PDMR SNPs, and we took their genomic position and added and subtracted a half a megabase. So we formed a 1 megabase window around those SNPs. And we've also taken the SNPs in these other analyses, which were above that red line. They were above the significance threshold. And we formed the same size window around them. And we asked the question, do these regions overlap? And the answer is yes. About 22% of those 27 SNPs overlap. Those regions overlap with regions identified in the AFI analysis, 7% in the RFI analysis, and here's what I was talking about on that previous slide. It's about 77% of those 27 SNP regions are also identified in the average daily gain analysis. And that does have a few potential implications. So the more data we have, the better our feed efficiency predictions will be. It might be possible we could use this data to bolster feed intake databases to obtain more data for these predictions, provided we use it as an indicator trait, such as percent IMS. However, there is a potential correlated selection response in average daily gain, as evidenced by the past two slides there. So we need to be cognizant of that if we're going to use this data, that we might have problems with increased mature size or increased maintenance requirements in other areas of the production system. So just to briefly conclude, we found that about 1,500 to 10,000 SNPs are needed for accurate generation of a genomic relationship matrix using methods that we use. We performed a genome-wide association analysis, which produced marker panels that explain approximately 54 to 62% of the genetic variation in our population for AFI, RFI, and average daily gain. And one of the things you'll notice is I bolded our population, and I did that on purpose, because it's important to note that these SNPs were identified in our population, and these estimates of variance explained are directly related to our population. And in order to know the true effect of these markers and find out if they're useful in other populations, these SNPs need to be validated in other populations and compared to other literature results that are out there. And we plan on doing that, but it hasn't been completed yet. Also, predicted dry matter required phenotypes should be further evaluated, again, in other populations for use as an indicator trait for average daily feed intake. With that, I want to make sure I acknowledge a lot of people that helped along the way with this project. First, I'd like to thank Circle A and MFA for providing samples and data on all of the animals that they did, as well as the breeders and semen distributors that provided semen samples towards that AI bull population. I'd also like to thank Drs. Weber, Taylor, and Schnabel for directly influencing this project. I'd also like to thank Dr. Sally Northcutt at the American Angus Association for providing the pedigrees on all of these animals. And last but not least, I want to thank all of the people in the lab. And with that, thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to take any questions you have. That's something we could have done. We didn't end up doing that. I believe Dr. Taylor had done that previously, and the results didn't differ significantly for this particular population. But in some populations, that would definitely be an avenue to take. Uh-huh. No, the actual feed intake were obtained through either the GrowSafe system on those MFA calves or the tailing gate system that Circle A had at the time. And then the predicted dry matter required phenotypes were derived from that data. Donald? We did. They actually, let me go back to that slide really quickly. Okay, so those 1,707 AI sires are included in this 2,405 here with these average accuracies of about 0.3. Right, and I did pull them out at one point. It's been a while, so I can't tell you exactly what the numbers were. They were, I think, slightly lower than this, but not much. If I had to pull a number off the top of my head, I'd say they were in the upper 0.2. Any other questions?